this entire discussion is moot, because now we know, given the way that the Russians are prosecuting this war, that never had anything to do with the ostensible motivations that they cited in late 2021. Given the way that they're prosecuting this war, we know that it's about the destruction of the Ukrainian state, given what they say and what they're doing. So I think it's important to also give the Russians agency, to give Mr. Putin agency, to understand that he might have motives which go beyond things that we do or go beyond the things he says that he thinks we'll understand. Now, on Cuba, Cuba encourages me in an odd way, because in Cuba, the Americans made a deal. We pulled our missiles out of Turkey. That was the deal. I think there are arrangements that can be made to stop this war. I think there are compromises that can be found.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Clearly, a discussion that we need to continue at a future date. Timothy Snyder, Yale professor of history, author of many books, including The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America, and Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the second Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland and Multnomah County's Director of Joint Homeless Services announces plans to resign. The FDA has expanded an infant formula recall following a child's death. And in international news, Russia intensifies its attacks on major Ukrainian cities as fighting continues. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 1st, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Russia continues to hit major cities across Ukraine with increasingly heavy shelling as the conflict escalates on its sixth day. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of war crimes and state terrorism on Tuesday, later receiving a standing ovation from the European Parliament as he vowed to keep fighting for his nation's freedom. His words even caused a translator to choke up during his speech, which was delivered by video call. Meanwhile, a vast convoy of Russian forces threatened Ukraine's capital of Kyiv. International condemnation and crippling sanctions have turned the Kremlin into a virtual pariah. Moscow now confronts a spiraling economy and determined resistance from Ukrainian forces. U.S. officials said they feared Russian President Vladimir Putin, frustrated by his military struggles, may resort to even more brutal violence. Facing fierce resistance on the ground, Moscow appeared to ramp up its assault from the air, which Ukraine and international watchdogs said was increasingly hitting civilians. Ukraine said Kharkiv, its second largest city, was coming under intensifying shelling from Russian forces, accusing them of war crimes for striking residential districts and government buildings in the city of around 1.5 million people. Western officials have said they think Putin's aim is to remove Zelensky's government and replace it with a Kremlin-friendly regime as part of a bid to restore Russia's influence over its neighbors. But seeking to tighten his country's bond with the West, Zelensky signed an application for his country to join the European Union. According to figures released Tuesday by the UN Refugee Agency, the fighting across Ukraine has forced around 660,000 people to flee to neighboring countries. The UN Human Rights Office said it has recorded the deaths of 136 civilians so far, adding that the real toll is believed to be far higher. The Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission has directed independently owned liquor stores in the state to stop selling all Russian-manufactured distilled spirits. The move comes in response to Russia's unprompted invasion of Ukraine. There are approximately 5,000 bottles of Russian-made liquor across 281 stores in the state. More than 6,200 bottles are in the warehouse distribution center, but the OLCC has stopped fulfilling orders for those products. Liquor stores in Oregon will still carry some brands that have Russian names, but not liquor purchased from distilleries located in Russia. There's a number of liquor brands that use Russian names and branding that are not distilled or made in Russia. No special orders for Russian-made liquor will be fulfilled for customers. Several states, including Utah, New Hampshire, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, have made similar moves in the name of dissenting against Russia's decision to invade Ukraine. Meanwhile, liquor is not the only way Oregon is tied to Russia. The Oregon State Treasury holds roughly $122 million in Russian assets, including bonds, public equity, and currency. It's not clear at this point whether Oregon will divest partially or fully. State Treasurer Tobias Reed said, quote, "We support the people of Ukraine. I've asked my team to fully evaluate the portfolio's exposure to investments in Russia and to identify our options as institutional investors." A revised bill that relaxes limitations on when tear gas is permitted to be used by police in Oregon will be reviewed on the Senate floor on Monday. Under the amended House Bill 4008A, there are three situations where police would be permitted to use tear gas. These situations include cases where the use is objectively reasonable to defend citizens or officers against danger to their lives or potential bodily injury. The use would also be permitted to safely control dangerous or illegal circumstances if de-escalation tactics fail. The revised bill would also require that a commanding officer authorize the use of tear gas. Before tear gas is deployed, police agencies must announce their intent to do so at least twice and provide enough time for people to exit the environment. Police agencies would also be expected to reduce the impact of tear gas, handheld chemical sprays, or less lethal munitions on bystanders, medics, and journalists when safe and possible to do so. In addition, they would be required to clean up debris left from firing tear gas and other less lethal weaponry. Indiscriminate use of handheld pepper spray or less lethal projectiles by police would be prohibited by the bill, but the use against specific individuals in a crowd would be permitted if the situation justified the use of physical force under state law. Police would also be expected to make an effort to inform area hospitals if they anticipate the use of tear gas, chemical sprays, or munitions. Nothing in the bill restricts police departments from adopting more rigid restrictions of less lethal weaponry. The current legislation on tear gas, House Bill 2928, became law on July 19, 2021. The bill prohibits the use of any chemical incapacitant and less lethal munitions in response to declared riots. According to testimony before the House Judiciary Committee, police worried that without the proposed adjustments, they would not be able to use weapons to stop belligerent or violent people in settings like rowdy sporting events or house parties. Lawmakers were urged by lawyers for the City of Portland, the League of Oregon Cities, and the Oregon Department of Justice to adopt their fix to the bill. However, many, including Sandy Chung, the executive director of the ACLU of Oregon, have opposed the amendments made to the bill. In a written testimony submitted to the Senate floor, Chung said the changes would weaken the current law. She also explained that not enough time was provided to lawmakers to review the changes. Chung is among many civil rights advocates that urge lawmakers to adopt stronger protections against the use of tear gas and other less lethal weaponry by police. The founding director of Portland's Joint Office of Homeless Services is resigning. According to an announcement Tuesday morning from Multnomah County Chair Deborah Kafuri, Mark Jolin, the director of the Joint Office of Homeless Services, will resign by the end of the month. The office is run conjunctly by the City of Portland and the Multnomah County governments. Shannon Singleton, a candidate for chair of Multnomah County and current director of Equity and Racial Justice for Governor Kate Brown, will take over as interim director of the joint office. The announcement said Singleton will end her campaign for county chair to accept the position, adding that she will begin on March 28th. Singleton, who has a master's degree in social work, started out in Portland as a resident assistant to the director at the Salvation Army's SAFES Women's Shelter, which was the first low-barrier shelter in the community. She went on to manage and develop homeless service programs at Bud Clark Commons, Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare, and the Portland Housing Bureau before succeeding Jolin as director of the Street Outreach and Housing Services at the nonprofit JOIN. She then served as housing policy advisor for Brown before becoming the governor's director of equity and racial justice. According to the announcement, Jolin will continue to support the joint office through the transition. Officials said the succession is a result of weeks of planning with Jolin as leaders from both governments work to transition the joint office into a far larger department. The elected bodies of Portland and Multnomah County voted in 2017 to expand supportive housing by 2,000 units over 10 years. That expansion set the table for Metro's supportive housing services measure, which voters approved in 2020. Jolin said the supportive housing services measure, which will more than double the joint office's budget at full allocation, is a game changer that will define the department's next phase. The governors of Oregon, California, and Washington jointly announced yesterday that students will soon no longer be required to wear masks in school. The West Coast states have had some of the strictest safety measures during the COVID-19 pandemic. Oregon, California, and Washington are lifting all masking requirements as of March 12th. In all three states, the decision of whether or not to follow the state guidance still rests with school districts. The announcement comes almost exactly 2 years after American cities began shutting down to flatten the curve. California was the first state to announce stay-at-home orders in March of 2020. California also recently became the first state to formally shift to approaching COVID like an endemic disease, with a plan that emphasizes prevention and reacting to outbreaks versus mandated masking and business shutdowns. Republicans have pushed for easing mask mandates. However, recent polls have shown that more than 60% of California parents still support students wearing masks in schools. The joint West Coast announcement came after the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention lightened the federal mask guidance last week, saying the majority of Americans don't need to wear masks in many indoor public places, including schools. Masks are still required under federal mandate in high-risk indoor settings, such as hospitals, public transportation, and airports. The CDC has endorsed universal masking in schools regardless of virus levels in the community, but it is now recommending masks only in counties at high risk. Based on CDC risk criteria, 16 of Oregon's 36 counties fall under the high level of transmitting virus. Governor Kate Brown said in a statement, quote, "On the West Coast, our communities and our economies are linked. Together, as we continue to recover from the Omicron surge, we will build resiliency and prepare for the next variant and the next pandemic." An infant formula recall has been expanded after a child died who ingested the powdered baby formula. Officials with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration said Monday that Abbott Laboratories recalled some Similac PM 6040 cans and cases produced at a Michigan facility. A few days prior, Abbott recalled certain Alimentum, Similac, and Elicare baby formulas made at the same facility in Sturgis, Michigan, following complaints about bacterial infections in infants who consumed the products. The FDA had said it was investigating the consumer complaints. The investigation included 4 reports of Chronobacter sakazaki infections in infants and 1 complaint of a Salmonella Newport infection in an infant. Officials with the federal agency said Monday that Chronobacter may have contributed to death in 2 infants. Chronobacter sakazaki bacteria can cause serious invasive infections and premature death in infants. The most recent U.S. outbreak in 2011 reached across 4 states. The recalled Similac PM 6040 products were distributed to the U.S. and Israel with the lot code 27032K80. Other Abbott products should not be used if the first 2 digits of the lot code are 22 through 37, the code on the container contains K8, SH, or Z2, and the expiration date is April 1st, 2022 or later. Consumers can visit SimilacRecall.com to check their product lot code located on the bottom of the package. The FDA is advising consumers not to use the recalled Similac Alimentum or Elicare powdered infant formulas. The recalls do not include liquid formula products, and consumers can continue to use all products not included in the recalls. This comes as the U.S. is facing a shortage of baby formula. Manufacturers have said they're producing at full capacity and are making more formula than ever before, but it's still not enough to meet current demand. According to a lawsuit filed on Tuesday, officials in Texas have begun investigating parents of transgender adolescents for possible child abuse. The investigations by the state's Department of Family and Protective Services were launched in response to an order from Governor Greg Abbott, who directed the agency last week to handle certain medical treatments as possible crimes. The order followed a non-binding opinion by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton that parents who provide their transgender teenagers with puberty-suppressing drugs or other medically accepted treatments that doctors describe as gender-affirming care could be investigated for child abuse. The order would mean that all licensed professionals who have direct contact with children would be required to report to state authorities those that they believe are receiving gender-affirming treatment or face criminal penalties. On Tuesday, the American Civil Liberties Union of Texas and Lambda Legal went to state court in Austin to challenge the legitimacy of the investigations and the power of the governor to change the definition of child abuse. It's not clear if Abbott's order would survive judicial scrutiny. It does not change Texas law, and several district attorneys in the state have said that they would not prosecute families for child abuse under the new definition. The moves by Governor Abbott and the Texas Attorney General, both two-term Republican incumbents, come just as each faces significant challenges from far-right opponents in their primary elections. Paxton, the Texas Attorney General, has been indicted on security fraud charges and accused of corruption by his own former top aides, and has been seen as particularly vulnerable. Paul Castillo, general counsel at Lambda Legal, said in a statement that the move was part of a, quote, politically motivated misinformation campaign with no consideration of medical science, adding that, quote, gender-affirming care for the treatment of gender dysphoria is medically necessary care, full stop, end quote. The effort to stop treatments for transgender teenagers has been sharply criticized by professional medical groups and by transgender health experts, who have said that such decisions, particularly those that carry medical risks, should be weighed by a patient, their parents, and their doctors. At the same time, legislation to ban gender-affirming treatment for teenagers has been introduced in more than 20 states across the U.S. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with author Tom Hartman on his new book, The Hidden History of Big Brother in America: How the Death of Privacy and the Rise of Surveillance Threaten Us and Our Democracy. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 47 degrees. Tomorrow will again be rainy with a high of 50 degrees. Today in history, in 1961, President John F. Kennedy issues an executive order establishing the Peace Corps as a new agency within the State Department. The Peace Corps captured the imagination of the U.S. public, and during the week after its creation, thousands of letters poured into Washington, D.C. from young Americans hoping to volunteer. Peace Corps enrollment peaked in 1966 with more than 15,000 volunteers in 52 countries. Budget cuts later reduced the number of Peace Corps volunteers, but still today, more than 7,000 Peace Corps volunteers are serving in over 60 countries. The quote of the day is from American politician John F. Kennedy, who served as the 35th President of the United States. Kennedy said, quote, "Let us not emphasize all on which we differ, but all we have in common. Let us consider not what we fear separately, but what we share together." Ukraine's UN envoy describes disturbing scenes from the Russian invasion. President Biden faces a tough audience for his first State of the Union address, and a trucker convoy upset over COVID-19 rules heads east. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There is no debate. These are war crimes.
At an emergency session of the United Nations, Ukraine representative Sergei Klizlytcha described scenes from the Russian invasion.
Russia is attacking hospitals, mobile aid brigades, and ambulances. This is not the action of a state with a legitimate security concern.
Ukrainian and Russian delegates held direct negotiations, but no compromise was reached. As the invasion entered its sixth day, UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths reported a rapidly growing humanitarian crisis.
Civilian children, women, and men have been injured and killed. Homes have been damaged.
It's estimated more than 500,000 refugees have fled Ukraine, and a dozen Russian diplomats were expelled from the UN for, quote, espionage activities. There are unconfirmed reports Russia used a thermobaric weapon known as a vacuum bomb in Ukraine Monday. When asked if Americans should be concerned about nuclear war, President Joe Biden said no. The conflict is expected to be a top talking point. Biden will present his plan to lower costs for Americans by making more products in the U.S., promoting fair competition, strengthening supply chains, and eliminating barriers to well-paying jobs. He's also expected to call on Congress to address rising inflation. Meanwhile, a new Yahoo News YouGov poll found 41% of U.S. adults surveyed approve of the president's performance, while 53% disapprove. More than 6 in 10 Americans said Biden has not kept most of his campaign promises. President Biden's Supreme Court nominee, Ketanji Brown Jackson, will hold her first meetings with Senate leadership from both parties on Wednesday. During a Black History Month event at the White House Monday, Vice President Kamala Harris praised Jackson as a phenomenal justice.
She has a brilliant mind and a record of excellence, a record that proves she will administer equal justice.
Jackson could be confirmed by the Senate before the chamber's Easter break. Legislation to classify lynching as a federal hate crime was passed by the House. The passage comes more than 120 years after the first federal anti-lynching bill was introduced by then-Representative George Henry White, who was the only Black member of Congress at the time. Congressman Ted Deutsch of Florida is now the 31st House Republican who will not run for re-election in November. So far, only 13 House Republicans have said they will not seek another term. Convoys of truckers are headed towards the nation's capital, pushing off from various starting points throughout the country. Mike Landis, organizer of the People's Convoy, says they are fighting for health freedom.
We want this government to bring back the Constitution by ending the Emergency Powers Act.
The convoys are expected in Washington, D.C. by the weekend. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eTrust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Supreme Court agrees to hear several Indian Child Welfare Act cases. A Montana tribe has big plans for their part of the $1.7 billion infrastructure bill. And South Dakota tribes react to the takeover of a Rapid City Health Center from federal services. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Supreme Court announced Monday it will hear challenges to the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA. The law is intended to keep Native children with Native families, as Tripp Krause reports.
The law was passed in 1978 in response to the disproportionate removal of Native children from their homes, families, and communities. The Indian Child Welfare Act is a federal law that is used in Native child adoption cases. Many of the arguments opposing ICWA say that the law illegally discriminates against non-Native families based on race when placing Native children in homes. And that's the argument at the core of Brackeen v. Holland. The case began as a lawsuit in 2018 in Texas. It challenges ICWA as a race-based law and says it should be struck down based on equal protection grounds. In April, the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals divided on Brackeen v. Holland in a split decision and ruled that parts of ICWA were constitutional while other parts were not. Because of the split decision, the ruling applies only to the judicial district, which includes Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas. In September, four tribes, the state of Texas, and several parents filed petitions to ask the Supreme Court to review that decision. The Supreme Court has consolidated all of those petitions but not yet set a date to hear them. For National Native News, I'm Tripp J. Krause.
The U.S. Department of the Interior announced last week it will use $1.7 billion from a recent infrastructure bill to fund outstanding water settlements with tribes. Aaron Bolton reports one tribe in northwest Montana says that funding will launch some irrigation projects this summer.
The Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes Chairman Tom McDonald says the announcement from the Interior Department will go a long way toward implementing projects to improve the reservation's irrigation system. Congress passed the $1.9 billion CSKT Water Compact in 2020.
They have projects that will be lining canals in the Jocko area.
The Blackfeet and Crow Nations will also receive funds for their water compacts.
For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The Oyate Health Center's goal is to become more self-sustaining after the Rapid City, South Dakota Center assumed control from the Indian Health Service. Richard Tubles reports.
The Susan Hospital in Rapid City primarily serves members of the Ogallala Sioux Tribe, Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, and the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. In 2019, the Ogallala Sioux Tribe and the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe contracted with the Great Plains Tribal Leaders Health Board. The board manages the Oyate Health Center on the hospital campus on behalf of the two tribes. Federal Indian Health Services has been providing health care services on the campus to members of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. But recently, the tribe contracted with the health board, paving the way for the Oyate Health Center to provide services on behalf of all three tribes, utilizing funding from the IHS. Brandon Ekefee is the health board spokesperson.
The ultimate goal is for this facility to be self-sustaining. We don't have to refer, our relatives out to Monument or to Avera, but to be able to build that in-house capacity, which, also builds community capacity and generates economic development within the community. And, leads to an overall better healthcare experience for tribal members.
Over 60% of Indian Health Services funding is administered by tribes. This gives tribes the control to identify and meet the specific needs of their members. In Rapid City, I'm Richard Tubles.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Sea level rise could bring toxic floods to the West Coast. In California, pollution from inundated Superfund sites, sewage treatment plants, and other industrial sites could flow into neighboring communities. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As sea levels rise in California, beachfront homes are not all that's at risk of flooding. Many industrial sites are also located in coastal areas.
There are refineries, sewage treatment plants, power plants, legacy hazardous waste sites, Superfund sites, cleanup sites.
That's Laura Cushing of the Fielding School of Public Health at UCLA. She says if these industrial sites flood, hazardous pollutants could be released into nearby communities. So she's working on the Toxic Tides Project, an effort by researchers and community partners to quantify the risks and raise awareness about the issue. The group has created online maps that show where hazardous facilities are located in California and how likely each is to flood this century under a worst-case climate scenario. The maps also provide census data about the people who live near the most flood-prone sites.
You'll see higher rates of poverty, higher proportion of residents identifying as people of color.
So the maps also highlight environmental injustice. By sharing data, the team hopes to help state and local leaders protect vulnerable coastal residents from hazardous waste. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 1st, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Caitlin Backus and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, Emily Scott, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or download our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for an in-depth interview with author Tom Hartman about his new book, The Hidden History of Big Brother in America, How the Death of Privacy and the Rise of Surveillance Threaten Us and Our Democracy.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Internet companies scoop up a lot of data on their users. The saying goes, if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. And the outcome isn't just really specifically targeted ads. It can also result in behavioral control and serious threats to democratic norms. Today, we're speaking with progressive radio host Tom Hartman, who's the author of the new book, The Hidden History of Big Brother in America, How the Death of Privacy and the Rise of Surveillance Threatens Us and Our Democracy. The book launches at Powell's on Tuesday, March 8th at 5 p.m. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today. I enjoyed reading your most recent book, The Hidden History of Big Brother in America, How the Death of Privacy and the Rise of Surveillance Threaten Us and Our Democracy. But I gotta say, it's put me a bit on edge. It comes out on March 8th, and there are so many critical pieces of information in there. Like, even if you followed privacy, surveillance, data mining, all of this kind of stuff, seeing it all in one place really, like, paints the whole picture. So I want to start with the idea of Big Brother, right? That's the title of the book, which comes from George Orwell's 1984. Why did you decide to use that term to characterize the loss of privacy and surveillance phenomena that you describe in the book?